So we'll have this time to play with some of the questions that came into the little box. And I first wanted just to read several of the questions because I find it so beautiful to hear how different voices, people coming from different places, kind of in a way asking about the same thing. And then I hope to go back to each question. Also, at the same time, if we understand that each question could be enough to talk about for an hour, and we have maybe 20, so it'll just be playful, kind of using the questions to just feel a little bit deeper, but not trying to answer really the question completely. So, one question. What is inspiration, and what are its preconditions? Another one. As we practice to eliminate ignorance, I wonder if we can continue to live within or alongside the society which is devastating and threatens to destroy the very life support systems we depend on to live. Should right lifestyle, in quotation marks, be considered an important ninth step on the Buddha's path to enlightenment? Another question. Who are your teachers? Who has influenced you? Do you have a guru? Thank you. Another question. Where is my home? They might have confused me with a J. A J is the one who does real estate. But this is a beautiful question that I'm not only going to make fun of. And one more, just to get the flavor, like to feel how beautiful each person's way. You mentioned, so the note says to me, you mentioned deep love, in quotation marks, in the last talk. What does that mean? Does it mean loving everyone no matter what they say or do to us? And there's more that we'll go into too, I hope. So what is inspiration and what are its preconditions? As I state the question again into the hall for us, I'd like to leave it open if someone has a further question from something that I say. And at the same time, in a way, like if we find more questions that are enriching for us, that for me is better than finding more answers. So, inspiration. A word that we can understand in many different ways. A really cool way of feeling into inspiration I find from this art called Jinshin Jutsu that I mentioned a couple of times, where we're doing weird things with our hands, like holding the shoulder and the hip, holding the fingers. They talk about, it's an art also of simply being happy. It's not only about physical healing or psychological healing or whatever. And they say always, if you want to tune into the breath, let yourself tune into the exhale first. So breathe out first. And then let the in-breath come. And the idea is that we learn how to make room. We learn how to let go of what's already with us, what we think is true, what we've experienced so far, what's kind of clogging our pipes, so to speak, what's trying to pretend it's important when it's not. Learning how to let that go. And by tuning into the out-breath, we can start to get the feeling of this very natural making space. And then the in-breath happens to come. And in Jinshin Jutsu, they talk about the in-breath coming in as limitless life abundance, or a storehouse of life energy, a storehouse of light. Which, by the way, is one meaning of one of my teacher's names, so we can weave a little bit the questions together. So what are preconditions to help us inspire? So breathe in inspiration. It's the same kind of root. That's why I used the Jinshin example, breathing in, receiving the in-breath, receiving inspiration. Many people who have looked closely into life say that teachings are all around us, available to us. Not just that kind of teaching like where we're in a bad mood and then the world seems to be in a bad mood against us and so on. That's also there, but that real, like, subtle teachings could be coming in. We could tune into that. But the receptivity is lacking. So breathing out, making space, getting out of the way, getting what we think we have in its right place, we've got it figured out, we've got it sorted out, letting it go. Once you've got it sorted out, let it go, give it on. The question, I like the question, who are your teachers? And I think of so many people, including the many teachers I have that I have never met. And one of those is Matisse, a painter that you may have heard of. And he was asked how it is that he can find inspiration to paint all the time, because he was a very productive painter over many, many years, whether he was popular or not. He kept on painting. And he even says, just keep painting, no matter what. But then this one journalist asked him, what do you do when you don't feel the inspiration? And he said, don't paint. If I don't feel the inspiration, I maybe, like, for example, he said, today or yesterday, I went on a horseback ride, and I came back, and I was inspired, and I painted. So he's someone who was really day in and day out for many years, even when he was about 12 years in utter poverty, surviving on his wife's earnings from a hat shop. He kept on painting. So this is very much applicable to other areas where we might want inspiration, including meditation. So one way to, let's say, excuse me for the crude metaphor, but flush the toilet, if you want to breathe out, it might not be to come to the meditation hall. It might be to do what for you would be riding a horse, how that was for Matisse. Another way that we can get out of our way for inspiration to come through is by also losing our sense of how small we are. So sometimes we need to get out of our way because we think we've got it all sorted out, and that knowingness is in the way. But other times, some inspiration comes that is so inspiring, that's so radical or so powerful, and we think, that can't be, I can't say that. I can't paint that. That can't be happening in my meditation. Did that really happen? So also the confidence in life, that life is in us. And just like with the breath, we breathe out and the breath comes in. So, as we practice to eliminate ignorance, I wonder if we can continue to live in this devastating culture. Should right lifestyle be considered an important ninth step on the path to enlightenment? So this is referring to the Buddha's Eightfold Path. Adding another step. So one way to look at this question is if we would really become intimate with the eight steps of the Buddha's path, such as really finding the first one is called right view. And it doesn't mean right as opposed to wrong. It means like the deepest and clearest we can find right now. If we can stick to that more often, and then from there, we allow influence in our thinking, in our action, in our way of making a living, in our meditation, etc. The world outside, the culture that we are participating in and enabling to destroy the planet, will change and does change. But I think it's actually also good to add on maybe not only one but two more folds in the Buddha's Eightfold Path. One of them is one of my teachers, Christopher Titmus, says, what about the ninth one being right relationship? So we have our deep meditation, we have our awareness, we have our really accurate loving speech, etc. We really consider how it is that we make enough money to eat and come to retreats. What else could you want to do? But what about right relationship? So in this case, Christopher was mostly pointing to personal relationship, one-to-one partnership, and maybe also friendship. I think that's an important one to add on to the Buddhist system, where the kind of most revered, the most honored people were the ones who left relationships, supposedly, who left the family and marriage and so on, who maybe left their children. So to bring in the importance of what is right relationship. And then definitely to keep going from there, not just the one-to-one relationship, but the like mutual, diverse relationship with everything that exists. And people are starting to talk more and more freely about this. In the opening talk at the Harvard Divinity School's new year, last autumn, the talk was about this. It was about how my waking up cannot leave out our waking up and our waking up and our waking up. And taking care of, in the way that I'm called to, not feeling forced to do more than that, but not doing less than what I'm really called to do. Taking care of contributing to a culture that respects diversity, that feels how we actually literally cannot live without, as this person says in such a very clear way, the very life support system, so the ecology that we are part of. So we know this and we've heard this, and what does that mean for us in the hall here on this retreat? One example we have are coexisting with monkeys. And one person brought the question of, and this comes up every year, how to relate to the monkeys without violence and yet without being attacked, without also creating a kind of dependence with the monkeys. So I think it was last year that some people were feeding human food to the monkeys. And then the monkeys, of course, were coming more and more close into the hall, et cetera, as they did today. And then the Indian staff had their slingshots, which is like you have a Y-shaped stick and an elastic string, and you put a rock in it, and you shoot the rock at the monkey. And so retreatants came in tears, feeling so touched, seeing this violence. So we can see the obvious violence, but can we see a kind of possible subtle violence of our trying to be kind by giving food to a wild animal in a place that we also don't live, that we are staying for 10 or 40 days? What does that actually do to the whole valley, to the people and the animals, and to the things that the monkeys would have eaten if they didn't eat the chapati, the trees, etc.? So feeling kind of, at the same time, the responsibility that is with us when we can feel the interconnection, without letting it be a heavy thing, but letting it move us, inspire us, and see more clearly and deeply. Sometimes we can actually find the care that's needed in the human culture by spending more time in the non-human cultures. Many people find it much easier to connect and feel a kind of care that moves us, sitting with trees, or with birds or with monkeys. And then if we could feel that we need to bring that back to the human culture, that we can. As with the other steps or folds of the Buddha's Eightfold Path, now we have a Tenfold Path. It's important to first come to the experience of, so in this case, experience of interconnectedness, and how delicate life is and how much we not only depend on each other and affect each other, but like our very life depends on. And certainly, we could say, even more important than this one life, our awakening depends on experiencing that interconnectedness. If it comes from the experience and not the idea, so if it can be like not a top-down mental idea that we force ourselves to try to care about the monkeys, but we could try to experience, let's say, practice loving kindness for the monkeys, if we're concerned about the violence that we see as the only solution so far to keep them away. If we would take spending 5 minutes in a place that we could actually feel the interconnectedness as equally important as spending our 30 or 40 minutes in silent meditation and spending our 4 hours or 8 hours or 20 hours of trying to make a living. If those at least 5 minutes of tuning into the vastness of and diversity of life, I think that would actually move us much closer to the freshness that's needed in our practice. Okay, who are your teachers? Who has influenced you? Do you have a guru? What comes to my mind is, let's say, the most honest answer I've ever given publicly about what my teacher is. I have many, many teachers. And I am incredibly blessed of the ones that I've ended up connecting to. And I do think there is a kind of very individual chemistry that happens between someone who's learning and someone who's called a teacher. But to my real experience of what, let's say, my guru is something, I will say something, but it's not just like the vastness. It's an actual guru that I have only met in deep meditation. But the first time I met that was on my first long retreat in Bodh Gaya with Christopher. And I knew and I didn't know that that was my teacher, my guru. And I met them again. It's more of a them than an it or a him or a her. And it's maybe only in the last few years that I understand that that's my teacher and that human beings, people, individuals come and help me a lot. Without them, I definitely would not be here. But in a way, it's almost like my inspiration to connect with them comes from my guru, whom I haven't met in form in this life. So teachers and influences. I studied comparative religion at Harvard, and I have to say it was incredibly rudimentary knowledge that was being offered there. So don't believe the name, really. And especially when in between, in my junior year, my third year, I came to Bodh Gaya and did a Buddhist studies program and met some meditation teachers for the first time, really. When I went back, I just couldn't accept that this is called religion, religious study. I managed, it was much easier to get A's actually after that because it was so silly. It was really just repeat what the teacher said. Okay. The first teacher that I met that I felt this kind of spark, that there's something going on that's not just about what this person is telling me, and it's not just about what technique I'm practicing, was a Tibetan teacher in Bodhgaya. The main thing that influenced me with him that I was consciously aware of was his laughter. He was making jokes all the time, and at the same time, kind of zapping us. And that really prepared me, as well as seeing the kind of scene around him, which was really crazy circus, especially us Westerners, really not so easy for me to take at the time. That really helped me to be able to connect to the next teacher I met, Punjaji in Lucknow, who grew up in a Hindu family and was teaching something that's an Indian spiritual tradition, but not so much of a religion. It's non-duality. But what he really showed me was that the intuition that's coming is enough, and I have to be much more quick in following it, like instantly follow, is what he was basically showing me. At the same time, the way that he was showing me, so in the talk the other day, I talked about the atmosphere, the space, the ether that's actually shaping us, the clay, the teacher, the water that keeps the clay soft to be shaped. So his sense of humor and love, he was very, with me, not with others, but with me, was very grandfatherly or fatherly, very loving, taking, I had very little money at the time. He would always send me things that I needed or thought he thought I needed or whatever. I was living in a little room on a rooftop of a friend's house, didn't even have a door, and we thought, well, we might as well like put a water tank and hook up a little kind of tap so that we could do laundry up here instead of having to go downstairs. And so he sent the water tank, that kind of thing. Very practical, very funny, and that kind of zapping energy going on. And so in that kind of crackling atmosphere, very homey, relaxed, funny, but ready to zap you at any moment. He would just say things sometimes under his breath that would remind me to be quick, to be right on the spot. Not like, oh, that intuition, maybe tomorrow I'll be brave enough to ask him that question. No, now. He also, with the laughter and mischievousness, not following the rules of what spiritual people are supposed to look like and do, he was 80 and stronger than most of my biggest, strongest friends, no matter what age. He could pretty much still, he was a wrestler when he was younger. He wrestled one, really the tallest and one of the strongest men that was there, wrestled him to the ground. Without, you know, as if nothing's happening, he's pretending to lean on my friend as if, oh, I can barely walk, I need your help, and then tattoos. Patriarchal. I was looking for a nice feminist woman. So just getting out of the head and going to the electrical atmosphere. Now I would say my understanding of what my teachers are is really my friends, so Ajay and Gemma and Jess especially. And I must, of course, include Gyan, my son, who's two. He's in the terrible twos now. I think that the just being in the quality of love and friendship as much as possible, being in that atmosphere that you want to be shaped by, even if you don't really understand or talk about that kind of thing much, but letting it shape you, is one of the most important things you could hear. And about Gyan, my son, a friend recently told me about a mother who had done plenty of spiritual practice, including martial arts, and she's a black belt in some, I don't know, karate or something rather, or maybe in several of the martial arts, I don't know, but she's done sort of everything, Tibetan Buddhist things as well. And her statement on motherhood as a teacher was, she said, I have never come across anything with this level of ego death. There he is. beeping Brahman Renji's car horn up there. That's right. Exactly what I needed. To add to that, so it doesn't sound like the other day only, like the deathless, the juicy part is, it's not just sort of a cutting away of like, oh, I thought I wanted to have dinner now. What about 2 hours from now? I thought I wanted to sleep tonight. Nope. All of the things that I thought I wanted to do and when I thought I had to do them, getting chopped away. But it's only because of love. It's only love that is chopping away. And so it's a very willing putting my head on the block. And the willingness, again, like the receptivity for inspiration, it's the willingness that is really our part. So actually, we could go to this question about deep love. Does deep love mean loving everyone no matter what they say or do to us? I think that in modern day mainstream cultures, the only real example that we have of the kind of love that was described in the story that I told two evenings ago about Gatikara and the Buddha Kassapa, where the more giving happens, the more bliss there is. I think that the parenting relationship is one of the few examples that we could actually understand and digest and that we could see around us. We don't really see many people who have a connection with a Buddha around. I think a lot of the Buddhas that are around are undercover Buddhas. The ones who are called Buddhas and wear Buddha robes are something else often. And so if there is a Buddha in our life, we don't recognize often. Or a Gatikara who is in one of the stages of enlightenment, not even a Buddha, and just a poor guy being taken advantage of. So when we see that kind of example of that kind of deep love, let's say in a parent-child relationship, I think in a way we almost find it embarrassing. Like I've noticed when people will see me in that kind of ego death situation, it's hard to know, but kind of fascinating and kind of horrifying. But we have kind of smaller tastes, let's say, of that deep love all the time. So it can happen, and sometimes it happens more easily on retreat. Maybe it so happens that someone puts a flower on your doorstep or on your cushion or by the food. There's some sweet gesture that didn't need to be there. It wasn't that someone's work period job was to put flowers on every doorstep or to put flowers by the pots of food or whatever. They were inspired, who knows why, to put a flower somewhere. And if we don't take it as a kind of, oh my God, now I'm obliged to go put another flower, or what does that mean, what do they want from me, etc. If that doesn't seem to be what's happening, if it's not a flower that's asking for something, if it's just a flower, if it happens to be just a flower and not a statement, and if we can receive it as just a flower and not a flower with a meaning, what happens? Does anyone have an experience? The feeling I would have is like I would want to give everyone flowers, or at least two or three. I would let that gesture happen, maybe. And I wouldn't worry as much about what will they think. Will they think that I'm coming on to them? What will they think? just letting the gesture come through. And then it tends to keep, instead of like trying to make the deal even or trying to get the better of you, you gave me a flower and I'm going to give you a leaf. Our training is, if you're going to give me a flower, I'm going to find a way to give you a leaf. That's our training. But our experience when we just get a flower for no reason is flowers come through. It might not be a literal flower, or it might be. And it can be scary if we try to like really let ourselves be taken away from ourselves by that. And so what if we're scared? So actually, there is another question that could give a good example, a good way of feeling into this same question. Is there any particular reason for not providing or stating the translations for the chants we sing? ? Could you tell us what they mean at the beginning? There is a particular reason that I usually don't tell a meaning of what we're going to sing. I did actually have the idea that this retreat I might just say the meaning, and I remember to do that the first night, and I didn't remember to do it the second and third times. So before I say what the meaning is, could we think about what does that mean to give a meaning to? So if we would give a meaning to the flower, oh, it means that that person is attracted to me, or it means that that person is trying to say they're sorry, or they're trying to look like they are special, or they're in a blissful state, or whatever. So just a small example with the flower I'm going to throw out in there. I don't know, now it's probably ancient history for some people, but there's a very famous photograph from the 1960s, 70s, from the anti-Vietnam War movement in the United States, where someone who was in the group called the hippies put a flower in the, what is it called, the muzzle of the gun of one of the soldiers that was standing guard. And it's just a kind of, it was supposed to be, it did have a meaning, it was a statement, it was a political statement. It was not a love flower, it was not probably, connecting to the person who was holding that gun. It made a great photo. The person who was holding that gun felt so ashamed to be the person holding that gun with the flower in it. Because the flower had a meaning, it was political. It was supposed to mean love, not war. But sometimes when we get too much in the abstract about love and war, we don't feel really deeply into this moment what is love and what is war. So if I would give, and I will give, the meaning for a song, and especially a sacred song, which is what I'm trying to bring to the evenings, I would need to make it short so that we have time to sing. So I might give, say, one line, like the first night. What did we sing the first night? Yes. May happiness be experienced in all the realms. Peace, peace, peace. If we hear that meaning, and then we think we know what we're singing, we might miss out on what could happen by singing with the exhale, leaving space for inspiration, and then the confidence to feel for ourselves what is meant. What does this mean to me? What applies to me now about these sacred words? What is happiness? What are all the realms? And what is peace? And so just for fun, I would love to hear, I hope someone might be brave enough to start. What was your experience, for example, last night? singing without knowing the meaning? What did you feel in the atmosphere as you were singing? Or the 3 nights ago, the Jai Bhagawan. If you don't know, if you haven't heard a translation. If you have heard the translation, it's so much harder to access your own real experience. It's so likely to be filtered between the lines of what you've heard it means. So if you don't know a translation of Jai Bhagawan, or the one we sang last night, I would love if anyone could say what you simply felt in the atmosphere as we sang. Yeah.
I knew the words, I knew what the meaning of them, and the day before, I didn't know, and it just came up, a meaning of my own, and it was much greater.
Anyone else? Okay. It's just that the ending of the singing is my favorite moment of the day. That silence. Okay, so maybe I'll try to remember when I ring the bell to say the meaning after we sing. To say a meaning, not the meaning. Yes. Yeah, yeah. Yeah.
Because like if it was in English,
yeah,
in a language that I knew, then I think maybe I would be lost in the meaning, and it would be hard to remove myself from the sound. But when it's not, the meaning adds to it.
Yeah. So I'm just gonna add another question into the mix here. Another paper says, when you talk about heart, do you mean emotions, or is there something more? One of the dangers with singing is that it can be such a great emotional high, and it feels good, and it can really be helpful sometimes to have that kind of emotional release. And you might have noticed that I do my best to avoid encouraging that. Like, we don't have the instruments and the drums and the bells and the... We have me, which these 3 times, my voice has come out very weird the first few rounds, which for me is perfect. Why? Because even if in the short term an emotional release would be helpful, there might be some deeper connection that cannot happen if the emotions are center stage. It cannot happen in the same way. So when I know the meaning of a song that I'm singing, sometimes it feels like it helps, but I feel that what it helps is to inject emotion into the words. And so I leave myself free to, on another retreat, decide if I give the meaning or not. On this retreat, I decided to, at some point, I don't know, before, after, at the end of the retreat, if I may just keep forgetting, and then. On other retreats, to say or not say the meaning. You can be angry or not angry with me. But just to point out that sometimes the emotional heart and being in touch with it and letting it flow feels so good that it can take over the space that something much more subtle and transformative and confidence-giving will take when it has the space. Does anyone else feel like saying what you felt in the atmosphere of singing?
Yeah, I'll say. I'm not sure if I can express this part. You know, when you're a little kid and you pretend to speak a foreign language and it's funny.
Can you hear? Almost. A little bit louder.
Just when you're a kid and you pretend to speak a foreign language and it's really funny to you, you know, you kind of get a kick out of it. There's a way that the words become much more, like, they have more holes in them when you don't know what they mean. And that, like, last night, I don't know Hebrew, and, you know, one word sort of was like my friend's daughter, and one word was like hi. And, you know, other words had, like, resonances, or just, like, these sort of loose associations to things that do have meaning to me. And maybe just because of the melody, too, I just found myself getting really kind of bouncy with it and pretending to speak this language. Mm. I had a half-hour conversation with a 6-year-old recently, where we spoke Chinese, and it was completely, we both completely understood the conversation.
Yeah, great.
That's what it was.
Okay. Anyone else?
Well, I wrote you that. The first question was, I thought it was Bhagavan, and then I thought, well, Bhagavan, I don't know, really. But actually, it was my mother's birthday that night, so I decided whatever we were going to sing, I was going to sing for her. So I didn't know what it was, but it was perfect. It was coming from a real space of just healing and saying it, but in the back of my mind, it was, what is this thing? And Jaya is like, victory, this is good. Okay, good. Whatever it is,
Whatever it is, victory to mom, is that what you said?
It was my mother.
Yeah, okay.
And then, I teach song and drum, and so as a musician, last night I was having such a hard time, such a singing, gosh, I can't get into it, but absolutely no idea what this is. Mm. So, my fault, but.
Yeah. Okay. Where is my home? I think there might be two important answers, maybe three, that come to mind now. One is sometimes for people who have the backpack as the home, who have traveling as the closest thing to home. To be open that sometime it might be time to stay in one place, not because your parents wanted you to settle down 10 years ago, but it might be time from the inside to stay somewhere for a while. The next level of home that comes to mind, again, this would be a great topic for an hour at least, discussion. I've already mentioned that I think home is when we're in that atmosphere with those people that's so loving that it starts to rub off on us without our trying to. It's so loving that we actually might even turn out to be a much nastier person than we ever wanted to be, because we feel at home and we let the guard down and we stop pretending. And then that helps us see more clearly, let love into where it needs to get to, those painful places under the nastiness. And meanwhile, in all kinds of ways, not by trying to copy someone, but by letting the love in, letting that love outside connect with that deep love inside. And so when we start to see ourselves doing more and more crazy things, accepting surprises that happen. So just even little things, like when we were trying to be mindful and we, like the monkey, break the glass or whatever. If there's a strong reaction of, I'm so stupid, or I hope no one noticed, or whatever, that we could kind of unpack that and let the love in there. And the possibility that we could discover how good accidents are sometimes. There's a character in a book, one of my teachers, Alice Walker, never met her, but she writes novels. She writes very truthful novels. And there's a character in one of her books who tends to spill things and trip on things and break things. And yet, what she tends to spill and break and so on. So one time the Temple of My Familiar, she walks into someone's house and she spills the vase of flowers that's in the entryway, and the water gets all over something, some papers or a book or something. And then in cleaning the water off, just that page is the page that was needed. And this person is enough kind of lighthearted about her own messiness that it kind of allows that magic to happen, that unwinding. Where, okay, maybe next time I will try not to spill the vase of flowers when I walk in the door. But since I did, look, that was just what was needed. And when we spend even a little bit of time with even one person who really loves us and wants the best for us, not like just listening to our complaints about our partner or our parents or whoever, our children or whatever, but also willing to kind of help us see through the story and get over it. Like both. They could listen forever, and then they can also just say, are you still talking about that 3 years later? Waiting for the moment to say so. When we start to feel that a little bit, we can start to take that with us where we go. And so it can be a mobile home. Having a physical place that we stay for a long time can help a lot with the second question about the environment, about ecology. But also taking very, very lightly where we think our home is, our physical home, like wherever we happen to spend more time. So even now, here in Satthol, it would be easy to start thinking about my room or my place that I sit for dinner, that kind of thing. And sometimes if there is a deep compulsion not to take our place, maybe it's important to practice like going to that place that we love for having dinner. But with the kind of giggle underneath, like this kind of, like my teachers that laughed and made jokes all the time, and then the electricity was much more in the atmosphere, I can kind of pretend to take my place. Because underneath, I know it's not really about the place, it's about something getting strong enough in me, getting over how I was hurt. But if there's a place that we think this is my home, or there's a backpack that we think this is my home, but especially if there's a location on planet Earth, if we can deeply feel ourselves to be a visitor there, as a visitor, it's easy to take lightly what needs to be done today. If it's my place that I own, the list of things to do never ends. There's never going to be enough time to rest. As a visitor, it's easy to see what's the priority and take care of that. And that taking lightly and at the same time connecting and seeing and responding puts us in touch with that kind of, let's say, ultimate home. Where we can feel, I think, even in the room right this second, there's a kind of hum because we are here, because we feel called to that home. The home hum. Sorry. Do you think it is wise to masturbate on retreat? When I don't, my sexual thoughts and desires are much more intense and can really be difficult in meditation. When I do, I feel like it is not in the spirit of renunciation. Thank you so much. So this spirit of renunciation, especially in the area of sexuality, is a good place to try to understand what might be meant by renouncing. And especially in the area of sexuality, it's important to acknowledge that, of course, this is an area that's different for each person, and different for each person from day to day, but certainly from month to month, year to year. And also to look at the conditioning that we receive about sexuality and see how that is affecting us. I'd like to actually unpack this subject a little bit more. There was a Zen monk who said, he talked about sexual energy to his fellow monks, his students. And he said, it's the red thread between our legs that cannot be cut. So it's something that's with us and will be with us. For some people, it's much more in the conscious experience, and for some people, it's more in the unconscious experience. It's not to say that if it's not in your conscious experience, you're repressing, because there's also, as I said, these very much individual differences. For some people in this life, it's more of a subject, it's more of a specialization or whatever. But I'd just like to point out that for people who have had more of the conditioning, and this would include a lot of men, not all men, but a lot of men, that it kind of, according to the culture, should be part of your identity. It should be part of your experience, conscious experience. Sexuality, work, and aggression are considered to be things that men do. And what could be interesting, when sexual energy and sexual thoughts are coming more in meditation as we start to slow down, if that's coming more, it can be interesting to give space to that, to feel, if it's possible, what's that energy that I need to and want to learn how to live with? And then what is trying to get away from that energy and funneling it into a story or an attraction about a specific person? And just playing with that line. But also, equally importantly, what is not in my conscious experience? Like, what is, if my conditioning has kind of edged me more towards sexuality, what is it that I'm leaving out? What is it that the conditioning is tending to leave out? Which would often be emotion, tenderness, heart, these kind of words. So not as an either or, but seeing sometimes when there's a lot of one thing, there's actually something else that's calling for attention too. And we can go either way. We can go through the sexual energy and we'll come to the vulnerability and the emotion. Or we can actually look and see out of the corner of our eye, this is left out, and feel that stubbornness that I have with that idea. Or what I find worth raising my voice about is emotion. even though I'm not an emotional person. And then for people, which includes many women, but not of course all women, I'm not wanting to reinforce the stereotypes, but there is a lot of conditioning that would encourage women to have sexuality as an unconscious part of the experience. So we might be being moved in ways that are coming from sexual energy that we don't realize. We might find a lot of emotion in our conscious experience. We might find it easy to identify and hard to disidentify. So this is the spirit of renunciation, hard to make space for what's in my experience and also make space for what I'm not aware of in my experience. How to take the pressure off the things that keep taking over the conscious sphere. What often goes hand in hand for those of us where the sexuality is more unconscious, often will be emotion, but not anger. And so we can sometimes come across the anger and give some space to that. Find what is the jewel in the center of that rage. What often can also go along with a de-emphasized sexuality. We can notice that when there's fear of sexuality, sometimes that is like an indicator, like the more fear and thinking about, the more there's a need to somehow find a way of feeling our own sexual energy and reconnecting to that in our own sphere. In a safe way, we can be intimate with that energy in ourselves and let that empower us. The energy that's trapped in the shape of anger, the energy that's in the unconscious sexuality, is the power that could come through in a kind of creativity that really can talk about saving the planet. So the spirit of renunciation on retreat and off retreat. How to handle an energy that seems to be stronger than what we have in our hands, our tools, without causing harm. So it seems to me that the person who's writing the note has found a good kind of rhythm. If it's something is really taking over in our mind, finding a way to decrease the pressure. But we could also look for other ways of decreasing the pressure. If something is emphasized, what is being de-emphasized? Is there any question about this? So there's a somewhat related question about the renunciation, so we'll go into that a little bit more with this one. Every moment of mindfulness helps break the chains of attachment. So why are so many people reading and talking? So there's two questions that come to mind reading this note for me. One is to feel the caring in the question, caring about people's freedom, and maybe having found that for this person, what they call mindfulness has helped so much to break out of the chains of suffering. But then there's this looking outward that might not have had some mindfulness with it, looking outward at others and possibly judging others. And so what is mindfulness? Is mindfulness the outer activity of not reading and of not talking? Or can mindfulness come into every single thing? So on retreat, it is a treasure, and I want to offer the treasure to you, that really you could take the chance not to read, not to talk, not to write notes, to just let things flow into you deeply and touch you. The nature, the silence, your own inner voice. And when there's an impulse to make a comment or ask for something to not a manager, that would be a great moment for what is called mindfulness. Like, that means I'm so much with my experience that I have options. I don't have to say those words that come into my head. But it can so happen that from mindfulness, the inner instruction comes, read that page. And it would be a pity not to read the page, just because we would think mindfulness excludes reading. Another word for mindfulness is love. So much fully filled with life that I'm not able to believe the sense of lack and not enoughness when it comes up. That is included, but not believable. And so there's not a going towards trying to get confirmation by making contact with someone. There's not believing that I'm not enough, that there's a lack. I'm not believing the lack and then going to the book. There's so much fullness of life that I am daring to be filled with, that when that moves me to read a book, I do. And when it moves me to forget that I had books, I allow the forgetting. So mindfulness is not just remembering, it's also forgetting. Forgetting to believe in lack. Two more papers. What to do if anger arises out of nowhere? Because of the flies, people, noise, open doors, it is there, anger is there, pestering me, bothering me. I try to breathe it out, feel it, and let it go. But it insists, slides around. What to do? I like how the question says anger coming out of nowhere, and then it gives the triggers of the anger, because it's true, both are true. The flies trigger anger that's not about the fly. Something is ready to be angry, and here comes the poor fly to help me feel my anger and see how it works in the mind and see what it twists in the body. This is another really important exploration towards peace on earth. There's a saying, I think it comes from Tibetan Buddhism, we have all done everything. And in one day, what's happening in our experience, if we can really feel it honestly and softly, the kind of judgments against those bad companies who are destroying the planet just fall apart. And at the same time, when we allow the anger enough, so we don't say the anger is wrong, just like the flies and the people and so on. We don't say they are bothering me. We say, wow, I'm bothering the flies. What's going on that my mind is bothering the poor flies who are just doing their short, tiny little life cycle? What is it in my mind, in my being, that's bothering the flies? When we can accept this is actually anger at a fly, okay, that's probably the hardest step. If I can then feel it and let it be as powerful as it is, that's not quite as hard, but hard. But already feeling the power of that experience called anger, I'm kind of able to see I'm not what I thought I was, because what I was is not an angry person. For example, what I thought I was is not someone who gets angry about flies. What I thought I was is someone who can control my reaction to a fly. And what we see happening is this powerful force that we didn't create and that we can't turn off. So another one of my teachers, Pema Chodron, also never met her, an American woman who's a Tibetan Buddhist nun, talks about when we can actually feel the force of an emotion, we're having an experience of egolessness. We can see that that power is not in my control. And so that can already start to kind of situate our focus somewhere other than trying to get rid of the anger or manage the anger. Okay, try. She asked if I can say that again. If we allow ourselves to feel fully the experience of something like anger, it could be fear, shame, etc. It could also be joy. It doesn't have to be a negative emotion. Something that strong. It could be sexual energy. Something that strong. That we can clearly accept that I didn't make it. It's not my fault. It's happening. I can't turn it off. And maybe if it's a negative one, I don't like it. It hurts. If it's a positive, so-called positive, like joy, it kind of hurts. And it feels so good. But either way, the strength of the experience tells me that I'm not what I thought I was. And it points my interest somewhere other than a battle with the anger, or trying to contain the joy, or do something with the joy. Inside the emotions, there is a jewel that we need. So it's not just like surviving the emotional storm until it's over and we can get on with our life, but there's something in there that has something to say that we need to hear, but it's not the story, it's not the fly, it's not the person. Just like this note says, anger arises from nowhere because of the fly. It's a perfect statement of our experience, I think. What to do? Acceptance, willingness to feel what's actually happening, willingness to stop trying to control it. At the same time, willingness to stop believing the story. And willingness for it to be something other than what we thought it was. Willingness to feel that it wasn't or it isn't now anger. The same energy that was trapped by our conditioning as the shape of anger has a chance to flow into the shape of clarity. The energy that was trapped in the shape of fear and paralysis, inability to move, when it just meets softness, or I said mindfulness is love, when love catches it, fear can take its shape of, in Tibetan Buddhism, it's called, what is it called? All accomplishing action. So that's what Punjaji was teaching me. Now. Not tomorrow, not in 5 minutes. Doesn't matter that you're shy, ask the question. It's not about you. Just the question comes. It wants to use your mouth. It might not be your question. Say it. And then we start to experience, in actual fact, that interconnectedness that is our awakening and our last chance as a people. The last question is, what is meditation for you? What do you feel like while meditating? After a practice of many years, does the meditation or the feelings during meditation change? Can one see difference after long practice? or the process doesn't change and you have to deal with the same things. I hope I'm making myself clear enough. Thank you. The practice definitely changes. My experience in practice has gone from intense pressure on myself to practicing a lot of loving kindness, to doing a lot of sleeping, dreaming, resting, having very interesting dreams. To places that I can't describe. To let's say the word unremitting challenge comes to mind. So what I want to say, unremitting means unstopping, like continuous challenge. What I want to say by that last part is, if I remember myself well, when I was starting meditation and for a long time during meditation, I was basically looking for the relief when I could stop pressuring myself, which is what I thought I had to do to get somewhere. And when I realized that what I first had to do was stop pressuring myself, there was still a hope that some kind of wires in my brain would burn out, and other people would call me enlightened. And I would just be smiling all the time or whatever. Nice music. I think that I could describe what happens is that we start to love life so much, the big life, because the big life loves all the other lives so much. So that's just more simple. And then we're simply available for the big life, which means sometimes we're available for this, that, or the other small situation. And so ordinariness is not the worst thing on the planet that I most want to get away from, which I used to have nightmares about, ordinariness. The bad guy was the ordinary guy. So what I would like to end with is just this kind of invitation to take off the pressure earlier than later, because pressure is not going to take you where you want it to go. But it doesn't mean, like, the more ease we find inside, the more is demanded of us in continuing to deepen in ourselves, to include more and more and more and more, and not have like a one-sided kind of enlightened life, because we wanted to hurry and get there. And also demanded outside. So again, the story of the potter and the Kassapa Buddha. We're feeling that life can depend on us. The big life can fully depend on this little life, is the happiness that we were looking for. And it's not glory, and when it's at its best, it's not even at all noticeable. And, of course, I said I would end, but just to say that that was my way so far. And you'll have your way, and you have your way. So thank you for listening. I want to leave time for interviews before dinner, so